the Beatles had the right idea. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down, and I do appreciate you being round. Help me get my feet back on the ground. Won't you please, please help me?
Helping people is rewarding. The joy and satisfaction you get from helping people makes the work you do worthwhile. But this feeling of satisfaction also comes with a cost. A cost which has been labeled as the cost of caring. Your job as a helper definitely has its ups and downs. And while it's the ups that keep you passionate about your job, the downs can definitely take a toll. According to researchers, this toll is actually more common in those who work with children. The following is an account from a teacher who helped a child through a traumatic event.
I will never forget her. She was such a bright, talented young lady. At times, she was shy and withdrawn, but for the most part, she was shaping up to be the star pupil of my class. Around midway through the second 9 weeks, this young lady began missing days of school here and there, and that shy, withdrawn side was showing itself more and more. Her grades were slipping, and her appearance suggested something just wasn't right. I tried to talk to her, but she gave elusive answers and avoided one-on-one time with me whenever possible. The day before winter break, she showed up to school with a limp and a black eye, claiming she slipped on the ice on her sidewalk. I asked her if there was anything she wanted to tell me, and she broke down in tears. She told me what could only be described as horrific abuse by her mother's boyfriend.
When working with children, you can't help getting to know them well. Sometimes, the things you find out about the children you help are upsetting. Whether you are a teacher, counselor, therapist, child care provider, pediatrician, caseworker, or any other profession that deals with helping children, you are the ones who see the warning signs that things aren't quite right in a child's home environment. You are also the ones who help the child through traumatic events, such as the death of a parent, divorce, extreme poverty, or homelessness. As much as you try to emotionally distance yourself from these heartbreaking events, sometimes emotional involvement is unavoidable, and sometimes the stress of helping children can follow you home.
I was able to get her the help that she needed, and in the end, everything turned out the best it could. But as time passed, I just couldn't let it go. Maybe I could have done something differently. How could I have let it get to that point? It kept me up at night, and I found myself relying on frequent nightcaps to help me doze off. When I did sleep, I relived the girl's account in my dreams. I was scared for the girl, angry with the mother, and full of rage for the mother's boyfriend. I became increasingly irritable with my family and friends. I felt like no one understood what I was feeling.
Some of the situations that you experience as a helper may actually be causing you something called secondary traumatic stress. Secondary traumatic stress happens when, after assisting someone with a trauma, you actually experience stress that is related to the emotions and experiences of the person you help. Most people have heard about post-traumatic stress and know that it is a negative change in a person due to directly experiencing a traumatic event, like a car crash, natural disaster, or military combat. Both post-traumatic stress and secondary traumatic stress have similar symptoms, including difficulty sleeping, irritability, avoidance, nightmares, and the feeling of being isolated from others. The only difference between the two is that post-traumatic stress is experienced directly, while secondary traumatic stress happens indirectly when you, the helper, are helping someone else with their trauma. A list of secondary traumatic stress signs and symptoms may be found in the guide that goes along with this podcast. Because secondary traumatic stress arises from the cost of caring that results from helping someone through trauma and emotional pain, it is more commonly referred to as compassion fatigue.
My problems at home quickly boiled over into my classroom. I wasn't sleeping, and despite the amount of coffee I consumed, I was tired and lacking energy. I became hypervigilant with the other children in my class, determined that no other child was going to go through what she did, not on my watch. I became overly empathetic with my students, as if I was searching for something to be wrong. Each bumper scratch triggered an alarm in my head that it must be abuse. My job performance was slipping due to my constant worry, and this did not go unnoticed by my principal.
Compassion fatigue is like glitter. When one person has glitter, she shares it with you. Later, you notice that some of the glitter is still stuck to you, and you have trouble getting rid of it all. It is important to recognize when compassion fatigue is happening because it has an effect on you and effect on the decisions that you make as a helper. In fact, you may not even realize that compassion fatigue is affecting your decisions. Yet researchers have shown that people with high levels of compassion fatigue make poor professional judgment, experience a loss of motivation, and become overwhelmed by the unpleasant parts of their job. Recognizing compassion fatigue is important. I have included a link to a self-test called the Professional Quality of Life Scale in the guide accompanying this podcast. This test will help you determine how much compassion fatigue may be affecting you.
My principal sat down with me and expressed his concerns. He referred to my decline in performance and unprofessional behavior. It was then that I realized I needed help. Together, we decided that it would be best if I sought help from our employee assistance program. After some therapy and adjustments in how I cope with stress, I was able to appropriately process the situation and move on with my life. I have since experienced similar situations, but now I can recognize the signs of compassion fatigue, and I have learned how to cope with it.
When dealing with compassion fatigue, you must remember that before helping others, you have to help yourself. And one of the best ways to do that is to get a little help from your friends.
Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. Ooh, I'm gonna try with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Yeah, I'm gonna try with a little help from my friends. With a little help from my friends.
In fact, research finds that one of the best ways to reduce the risk of compassion fatigue is to have friends and family as a support network. Making sure that you take time to socialize with your loved ones allows you to leave work at work. Speaking of leaving work at work, researchers say another good way to reduce the risk of compassion fatigue is to take short breaks while at work and long breaks outside of work. Short breaks allow you to temporarily walk away from the trying situations you may encounter, while activities and hobbies outside of work gives you something to look forward to at the end of the day. And let's not forget vacation time. Even if it's just to sit around in your pajamas all day, the time away from work gives you the chance to wind down. Researchers have also found that getting enough sleep, eating healthy meals, and exercising are important factors in reducing the risk of compassion fatigue. Not only are the things we just talked about good preventative measures, they are also good ways to help cope with compassion fatigue once you are experiencing it. However, if these self-help strategies are not enough to help cope with symptoms, there are several other options for someone dealing with compassion fatigue-related issues. Most employers offer an employee assistance program. These types of programs can refer you to people you can talk to about the symptoms you may be experiencing. If you feel more comfortable talking to your family doctor, that would be an option as well. There is a specific treatment program for compassion fatigue called the Accelerated Recovery Program. This program helps professionals in handling compassion fatigue in order to help them learn to better manage their emotions and cope with symptoms when they occur. The Accelerated Recovery Program is followed up with a Pathways Program that focuses on aftercare and prevention. These programs together have been found to be extremely helpful in treating those with compassion fatigue. When thinking of compassion fatigue, I like to remember the airline's oxygen mask principle: secure your own mask before helping others. That is what we have to remember when dealing with compassion fatigue. We have to make sure we can help ourselves before we can help others. Charles Figley wrote that, quote, "providing a comprehensive overview of compassion fatigue for educational purposes is vital," end quote. And the first step to dealing with compassion fatigue is to make yourself and your colleagues aware of the issue. For more information, please look at the guide to compassion fatigue that accompanies this podcast. I hope you have found this information interesting and useful. Thank you for taking the time to listen.